chapter 4. John chapter 4. Going to begin a new series of messages on the subject of worship. So I'd like to read verses 19 through verse 24, John chapter 4. The woman, this being the Samaritan woman, said unto him, Sir, I perceive that thou art a prophet. Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and ye say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. Jesus said unto her, Woman, believe me, the hour cometh, when ye shall neither in this mountain, nor yet in Jerusalem, worship the Father. Ye worship, ye know not what. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour cometh, and now is, when the true worshipers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father seeketh such to worship him. God is a spirit. They that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. This, of course, is part of Christ's discourse, conversation with this Samaritan woman at Jacob's well, at the foot of Mount Gerizim. The Samaritans, of course, were a people of mixed Gentile and Jewish blood. The Jews absolutely detested them, would not travel through Samaria thinking that they would be defiled, that they would defile themselves by simply passing through. This particular woman, Jesus has been having a conversation with her, and he would eventually save her. He confronted her with her sin in verse 18. He said, For thou hast had five husbands, and he whom thou now hast is not thy husband. In that sayest thou truly. Now as soon as Jesus confronted her with the problem, she did what many lost people do. That is, she sought refuge in her religion. She immediately seeks refuge in her religion. And she wants to discuss the historical aspects of religion. She wants to discuss the traditions of religion. We see that in verse 20. Our fathers worshipped in this mountain. That's history. Our fathers worshipped in this mountain. And ye say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. Now, up to this point, the Lord hasn't really said anything about worship. But again, she's confronted with her sin. And like most lost people, she seeks comfort in her religion. Jesus, in response, plainly declared that her religion was a sham and that her imaginary spiritual knowledge was really ignorance. That's what he says there in verses 21 and 23. He said, ye worship, ye know not what. In other words, you worship ignorantly. He's saying, ma'am, your religion is a sham. Your religion is worthless. And he begins to draw her attention to the nature of acceptable worship. And if you read these verses, you see that the word worship, or a form of it, occurs 10 times, beginning in verse 19 through verse 24. 8 of the times, Jesus uses the word. She uses it twice there in verse 20. Jesus then uses some form of the word worship 8 times. 5 times, this is used in verses 23 and 24, and you can count them yourself. But 10 times, he uses some form of the word worship. So what he's talking about here is a matter of great importance. And in this conversation, basically what Jesus said to her, he reveals several things about worship. People have some strange ideas about worship. Even God's people have some very strange notions about worship. But as you read through these verses, you see from verse 22, ye worship, ye know not what. So there is such a thing as a worship that proceeds from ignorance. Ye worship, but ye know not what ye worship. So there is such a thing as a worship that proceeds from ignorance. There's also a worship that proceeds from knowledge. Jesus said there in verse 22, we know what we worship, we there being the Jews. We know what we worship. Another thing that he reveals about worship in verse 23, he says, the hour cometh and now is when the true worshipers. So there is such a thing as true worshipers. That being said, there is also such a thing as false worshipers. If Jesus makes a distinction by saying true worshipers, it is implied that there are also false worshipers. This is still true today. There are true worshipers. There are false worshipers. We see the object of true worship is declared in verse 23. The true worshipers shall worship the Father. Shall worship the Father. Verse 24, God is a spirit and they that worship him. So he gives us the object of worship. The object of worship is God the Father. The object of worship is God. He then, as he progresses in this conversation, he declares the framework of true worship. And he states it twice. He states it in verse 23, true worshipers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth. That is the framework of worship. In spirit and in truth. True worshipers worship in spirit and in truth. False worshipers, of course, do not. This is the framework of true worship. He mentions it again in verse 24. God is a spirit. They that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. So worship has a framework. And Jesus has declared what the framework of that worship is. So, that being said, it matters how we worship. It matters. People today have this strange notion that it doesn't matter as long as you're sincere. But when Jesus said they must worship in spirit and truth, it matters how you worship. And if there's such a thing as true worshipers and false worshipers, it matters. It matters how you worship. We see also from this conversation, or mostly what Jesus is saying, that true worship is pleasing to God. Notice verse 23. Again, he said, the true worshiper shall worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father seeketh such. That would be true worshipers who worship in spirit and truth. The Father seeketh such to worship him. Not that he needs worship. God doesn't need anything from us. But God does, it does say that he seeks. And what that means is that he's pleased with it. He's pleased with it. Now, the implication, of course, is that there is also a worship that is displeasing to God. And another thing we learn here about worship is the framework of true worship is imperative. And that's stated there in verse 22. They must. That's an imperative. They must worship him in spirit and truth. Nothing else will do. There's nothing to replace that. Must worship in spirit and truth. So we get some basic information from these verses about true worship. It is also of significance that Christ is teaching concerning worship here to an individual. He's not speaking to an assembly. He's not speaking to a mass of people. He is speaking to an individual. And what I believe the significance of that is, it shows the individual responsibility in worship. Even when we assemble together to worship, each one of us have an individual responsibility. We have an individual responsibility to worship. No one can worship for you. That is our individual responsibility. The truth is, we as humans are instinctively worshiping creatures. We will worship someone or something. That is the nature of man. Man will worship something or someone. Human beings worship. Doesn't mean that it's all true worship. Doesn't mean they all worship the same thing. But we are instinctively creatures who worship. People who fail to truly worship, people who fail to truly worship, are swept into this vast area of restlessness. They're very restless individuals. There's nothing more calming and gives us more peace than when we've truly worshiped the Lord. But people who do not truly worship really have no steady direction in their life. They have no sustaining purpose in their life. They sort of just wander around, get caught up in just about anything. The subject of worship, of course, is a dominant theme throughout the Word of God. In fact, if you think about it, to truly worship is our reason for existence. People say, well, I don't even know why God put me here, to worship him. That's why we're here. To worship God. The highest occupation of a child of God, or anybody as far as that goes, but the highest occupation that we can have is to truly worship. To truly worship God. Modern society, I believe, has witnessed the death of true worship. There are many contributing factors to the death, for the most part, of true worship. Number one, of course, would be the idolatrous nature of the human heart. Man by nature is an idolater. Man by nature, again, is going to worship something, and it's probably not going to be God. Man by nature is idolatrous. The idolatrous nature of man contributes to the decline of true worship. That being said, you have secularism, which is basically just the mental framework, the value structure of the masses. And you think about the mental framework of the masses. You think about the value structure of the masses. It's not conducive to worship. Secularism destroys true worship. Part of secularism, of course, is humanism. The philosophy of self. We live in a narcissistic society. Therefore, worship becomes an impossibility almost. The philosophy of self resulted in man being the focal point. That's why you have the mega churches today. That's why you have the contemporary services today. Because man is the focal point. That's not true worship. People get caught, well, I don't like the contemporary music. And neither do I. But that's not the point. It's not the contemporary music that causes it to cease to be worship. It's the contributing factor is man is the focal point. And when man is the focal point of worship, you have no worship, not true worship. So you have humanism is a contributing factor. Relativism, the belief that there are no absolutes. God said, you worship me must. That's an absolute. Worship in spirit and in truth. But we live in a society that does not want absolutes, and a society that has done away in their own mind with absolutes. And these are all contributing factors to the death of true worship. And they are even amongst us today. These things are a huge hindrance to true worship. Materialism. Again, all of this proceeds as part of secularism. Materialism, the love and pursuit of the material, the love and pursuit of fame, the love and pursuit of riches, the love and pursuit of pleasure. These things are not conducive to true worship. The main emphasis in this series of messages is what is true worship? What is true worship? I've been thinking about this for year and a half, and that is the subject of worship. And it has greatly disturbed me about myself. And we'll get into this more later. It's not our point tonight. But I believe that if we really look at the biblical definition of worship, we almost can't worship today. We almost can't worship today. And in the last year, going to conferences, I've sat down with preachers and I brought this up. And they... almost all of them, I'll say, what do you think? I believe we're in such a state that we almost can't truly worship God according to the biblical definition. Well, I don't know. Well, think about this, or this, or this. And the response every single time is, wow. That's depressing. It is. But I believe we're there. I believe we're at a point, and we'll get to this in a few weeks. We'll see this more clearly as we proceed. But I believe we're at a place where we almost can't worship God. And I can give many examples, and like I said, we'll develop that as we continue through the series. So what is true worship? What constitutes true worship? First of all, in order to understand what true worship is, we have to understand, we have to be absolutely certain who worship is for. Who it's for. You say, well, that's a given. I'm afraid it isn't. I wish it were so. But I'm afraid it's not. How many times people will make a statement, I didn't get a thing out of that. Who is it for? Worship isn't for you. It's for God. So we have to be absolutely certain. And I'm not saying we don't get anything out of it. But we have to be absolutely certain who worship is for. We have to fully understand the goal of true worship. And we must have an absolutely clear perception of the position of the worshiper, if we're even going to come close to understanding what true worship is. As we go through this series, we have four main points. Tonight we want to look at the worshiped and the worshiper. Those two things, if those aren't right, worship cannot possibly be right. Secondly, there is, what is worship? What is worship? Thirdly, we want to consider, and we'll spend several weeks on this one, the elements of true worship. And then the fourth main division will be biblical examples of spiritual worship. But tonight we want to concern ourselves with the worshiped and the worshiper. And we all will verbally agree who the worshiped is. And we will all verbally agree who the worshiper is. The one and only object of true worship is God. That's already stated here in John chapter 4. God in his character. God in his character, that is who he is, are the foundation of true worship. Now in this discourse with this woman of Samaria, when speaking upon the subject of true worship, the Lord directed her attention to God and his character. She said, God is a spirit. He directed her attention to the object of worship and also the nature of God. God is a spirit. Now, a month or two ago, we preached a message on Genesis 1, verse 1, in the beginning, God. And we stated in that message that that statement, in the beginning, God, is not to be merely viewed as introductory to creation. Those are foundational words. That principle is found throughout the Word of God. That principle is found in living life. In the beginning, God. That goes way beyond the creation of the universe. It is a very plain declaration and statement about the existence and the reality of God. It is also a statement about the character of God. In the beginning, God. That means that God is eternal in the beginning. It means that God is self-existent. It means that God is self-sufficient. The next word, in the beginning, God created. And then, of course, what follows is the record of creation. But the fact that God created shows that he's living. And you can read through Genesis 1, Genesis 2, shows that he is sovereign. And it shows that he is omnipotent. So we have the character of God. Those words, in the beginning, God, establish a foundation for living life. They declare the purpose and meaning of life. And they establish the foundation of worship. Worship begins with God. Now, in that message about a month ago, we're not going to re-preach that message, but just to review some things. We said what these words teach us, in the beginning, God. Where does the Bible start? It starts with God. God is the starting point. When I read the words, in the beginning, God, what that means to me is the first thing is God. The first thing is God. Or to even make it more simple, first God. Now, if we carry that through to our life, what a difference it makes. What a difference it makes in living life if God is first. First God. First God. What a difference. All the difference in the world it makes concerning worship. Living life does not begin with us. It begins with God. It does not start with us. It starts with God. In the beginning, God. The Bible does not start with our ideas. The Bible starts with God. Oh, people have all kinds of ideas about worship. But worship does not start with our idea of worship. Worship starts with God. He's the starting point. We see here in the beginning God. It does not start with the seen, it starts with the unseen. That's true in living life. That is true in true worship as well. It does not begin with the physical, it begins with the spiritual. In the beginning, God. That is true of living life. That is true of true worship as well. It does not begin with the temporal, it begins with the eternal. These are principles, first God, that will help you in living life. But it is also absolutely essential in worship. The second thing we see there, in the beginning, God, is that God is the subject. In the beginning, God. God is the subject. He's the substance. He's the essence. He's the center. He's everything in those words. That should be true. That's the principle we should carry on in living life. That is also true when it comes to worship. In the beginning, God declares that God is the source. He is the fountainhead. He is everything. That is a principle we need to carry on in living life. That is also a principle that is absolutely essential in worship as well. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And as you read through the account of creation, you see the authority of God. You see that God, He is the power. He has the rule. He has the control. He has the influence. Now, if we carry that principle through life, that puts us in a place of submission and subordination to God. It puts us in our proper place. In the beginning, God. It does not say, in the beginning, Dan Gordon. It says, in the beginning, God. That's where it begins. He is the absolute authority. That puts us in a place of submission. That puts us in a place of subordination. That will help us in living life if we apply that principle. And it is essential to worshiping God. It is essential. So, in the beginning, God, to me, again, establishes a foundation, not only for living, but, and of course, big part of living is worship. That's what we're created for. It establishes a foundation of worship. Now, if you go to the book of Exodus, chapter 20. Is it 10 to 8 already? Wow. Exodus chapter 20. I'm just getting started. The Ten Commandments. The preface of the Ten Commandments sets forth God as supreme. Exodus 20, verse 2 says, I am the Lord thy God. This is the preface to the Ten Commandments, which have brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. In the preface of the Ten Commandments, God is set forth as the supreme one. I am the Lord. I am the Lord. He is saying, I am the supreme one. What he says here in Exodus 20, verse 2, is said to enforce the commandments, and it is said has incentive to obey the commandments. In this preface, in verse 2, he gives three reasons, three chief reasons for keeping the commandments. Number one, I am the Lord. You don't need any other reason. He's saying, I'm sovereign. I am the Lord. That is the reason to keep the commandments that would follow. Secondly, his relationship to his people. He says, I am the Lord thy God. I am the Lord thy God. That enforces the commandments. That gives us incentive to obey the commandments. And thirdly, he has redeemed us, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Again, this is the introductory remarks to the Ten Commandments. What's that got to do with worship? Everything. The preface of the Ten Commandments teach us that because God is the Lord, because He is our God, because He is our Redeemer, therefore we are bound to obey whatever He says. We are bound to keep His commandments. Now, this preface of the Ten Commandments not only sets the foundation for obedience to His commands, but they are the foundation for worship. The first four commandments form a framework for worship. Consider the first four commandments, and then we'll be done for this evening. The first commandment sets forth the one and only object of true worship. Exodus 20, verse 3, thou shalt have no other gods before me. That's certainly true in living life. That is absolutely essential to worship. Now, man today has redefined idolatry. man that is Western civilization, probably people in the United States have the idea that idolatry is if you go and you carve a statue out of a tree, or bow down and bow down to a tree, or bow down to a rock, or then that's idolatry. But anybody who studies the Bible certainly knows that that is a very small part of idolatry. But the point here is, God is the only, very first commandment, God is the only object of true worship. I dare say, that rarely happens in our civilization today, where God is the only object of worship. The second commandment is given in verses 4 and 5. And the second commandment deals with the means and ways of worship. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God. So we see the means and ways of worship. We do not bring in other things to depict God. I despise so-called pictures of Jesus Christ. And as we've said many times, I wish in my life I would have never seen those pictures. Because let's be honest, when we hear the word Jesus, those pictures come to our minds, no matter how hard we try to fight it. And this second command is what you do not try to depict in pictures or any other art form. Heavenly things. So it tells us about the means and ways of worship. The third commandment, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. That shows the character of worship. Worship is not to be a vain thing. Now, again, people have greatly limited this commandment by taking the Lord's name in vain. They have limited it down to simply using the word's name as a curse word. Certainly that is one form. May I say that is one very small form. God's people take God's name in vain all the time. Anytime we use his name and aren't serious about when we use it, it's taking his name in vain. I mean, probably no one more guilty and more danger than someone who preaches about God. Because if you diminish from him in any way, have you not taken his name in vain? This is a serious matter. We have this tendency, it's our nature, to put these things in a little box that suit our lifestyle. But these things are broad. We are not to take his name in vain. I believe that shows the character of worship. Then you come to Exodus, the fourth commandment, which is basically stated in verses 8 through verse 11. Basically, verse 8, remember the Sabbath day, to keep it holy. That talks about a particular time of worship. God is the object of worship. There is a right way to worship him. We are not to vainly worship God. We take God's name in vain many times, and I'm speaking of myself. This distresses me. We take his name many times in vain, singing some simple hymns, when we are not giving serious thought. That's why it's not a funny thing when people make a joke about God. That's taking his name in vain. So we have the character of our worship. And there is a time, and we'll get into this more later, there is a time of worship as well. One more thing. In Exodus chapter 20, God's instruction to Israel about their worship and the building of an altar. We see altars all through the Old Testament. And God gave specific direction concerning an altar. Because an altar that really speaks of the means of Old Testament worship. But notice in Exodus 20, verses 24 and 25. An altar of earth shalt thou make unto me, and shalt sacrifice thereon thy burnt offerings, and thy peace offerings, thy sheep and thy oxen. God's establishing a foundation here for worship. In all places where I record my name, I will come unto thee, and I will bless thee. And if thou wilt make me an altar of stone, thou shalt not build it of hewn stone. That is, you do not make any carvings in it whatsoever. No cuttings. For if thou lift up thy tool upon it, thou hast polluted it. Now God is building a foundation for worship. What this is teaching us is that the altars in the Old Testament were to be very plain. They were to be very, very simple. Plain and simple. Today people build huge buildings and go to huge expense. And what will they say? God deserves the best. You don't find that principle here. I'm not saying God doesn't deserve the best. That's not what I meant to say. But what God is teaching us here in Exodus 20, verses 24 and 25, what God was doing was God was protecting them from the human tendency to become enamored with the outward. In worship, we are not to become enamored with the outward. We're not to become enamored with the altar. Our focus is to be upon God. But we have this tendency. And that's why God says, do not put any tool to it. He's protecting us from our own tendency to be enamored with that which is outward. To be more concerned with the appearance. Oh, how guilty we are. To be more concerned with the appearance than with the object of worship. If God allows, as He has us here, God allows you to have a very nice building, you thank God for it, but you never become enamored with this building. Never. Never lose sight of the focus. I've even heard Baptists make comments like, oh, when we were in St. It'd be hard to worship in a storefront. That would be difficult. I just don't know if I could get in the mood. You have no clue what worship is. People that make that kind of statement have no clue. Because you should be able to worship out here underneath a tree. If the church decides to assemble under a tree, that should not hinder worship. It's not about the building. We must be enamored with God. And I believe God's laying this principle there in Exodus 20, verses 24 and 25. So our point tonight, we'll continue next week. I thought I'd get through it all tonight, but the worshiped and the worshiper. We have to have those two things right. God is the worshiped, We are the worshiper. Brother Tim.